Welcome to The Message, a weekly Hamilton Spectator podcast. I'm John Wells, along with producer Aisha Nasser. The story in The Spectator is headlined, Dysfunction in the OR, and it reads not unlike a scene from a primetime hospital drama. It begins, a patient was on the operating table, undergoing heart surgery at Hamilton General Hospital, when an argument broke out between two doctors that escalated to the point that the anesthetist had to intervene. Quote, we need to focus on the patient, the anesthetist allegedly said to the two cardiac surgeons. You are upsetting me and I can't sew, said the surgeon. The surgeon's hands were purportedly shaking by the end of the confrontation. So writes Joanna Friketich, the Spectator's award-winning health reporter, in her two-part, 11,000-word series about friction, controversy, claims, and counterclaims at Hamilton Health Sciences in both the cardiac and neurology departments, that has come out of a Human Rights Tribunal of Ontario application filed by the former head of cardiac surgery at Hamilton General Hospital. The online link for Dysfunction in the OR is posted along with this podcast. The allegations of infighting and disputes among medical professionals at the hospital that permeate Joanna's reporting, the breaches of professionalism, and even secretly taped conversations, make for riveting and disturbing reading, or in the words of the CEO of Hamilton Health Sciences himself, in a letter to the editor that was published in The Spectator, it all makes for, quote, difficult reading. So here is Joanna Friketich to talk about the series here on The Message. Joanna, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
It's a big piece of work, and so let's go back to how this all sort of began in terms of the story and when you first started covering it, and tell me how Dysfunction in the OR came to light in the first place. You attended several days of this Ontario Human Rights Tribunal, where Hamilton Health Sciences has exposed some pretty heated conflict in its surgical workplace in this open hearing. How did you hear about this? How did it all come about?
Well, here at The Spectator, we keep an eye on legal cases, and we do that through the Canadian Legal Information Institute, or CANLI, which is an organization that makes legal decisions available online. Now, the catch with that is they only appear up there once an actual decision has been made. So not all court cases that are in progress or tribunal cases that are in progress show up there. And so, I keep my eye on that, putting Hamilton Health Sciences into the search every so often. And it just happened that in this case, the vice chair, who's almost like is the person who makes the decision in the case, she had made a ruling about witnesses. So that's why it suddenly showed up. It unfortunately meant that we missed a huge part of this case. It has had about 26 hearing dates, and we missed about the first 20 because this decision didn't show up until at that point in the case. So we started going to the case right away when we found out about it. The interesting thing is that those decisions don't even tell you what the case is about. So when we first went to the hearing, we had no idea what this case was even about. I only knew that Dr. Irene Cebulski had been the head of cardiac surgery at Hamilton Health Sciences, and I knew it was a human rights application, and that's about all we knew about it. And with the way the Human Rights Tribunal works, they don't have dockets for you to check to see what cases they have coming up, and they don't post anything that tells what those cases are about. So we just went to the case and to see what was going on.
So you went there that first day, and you may well have been there and found that it was dry material and not worth reporting, but I guess that's not what you found. You found it was quite interesting and in the public interest to continue attending.
Absolutely.
And as you said, you have covered court often in the Spectator in the past, and that's a case that they will post the docket on what case is coming up. We're aware of that. This one, so this is a human rights tribunal. This did not take place at the courthouse then, correct?
No, this takes place, actually it's at moving locations. So far it's been at a hotel in Hamilton, and it's also been at a student residence in Hamilton. So it moves around. They tell me pretty much last minute where it's going to be, and I show up.
And who presides over it then?
She's called the vice chair, she's with the Human Rights Tribunal, and she's the one who makes all the decisions in the case. There's no jury, or it's not like a panel. It is one sort of adjudicator.
Right. And now you mentioned Dr. Irene Cebulski. So the Human Rights Tribunal application is rooted in a complaint filed by Dr. Cebulski, and then counterclaims made by Hamilton Health Sciences, which in turn for this case, for this hearing, provided information about care at the hospital. Clearly not always flattering information that you reported, you know, contained in reviews, internal reviews that it had done itself on its neurology department and cardiac care department, where Dr. Cebulski was the head, essentially to defend the hospital, defend the corporation against her version of events. Is that, do I have that right?
Yes. So a lot of what came up at the hearing was actually brought forth by Hamilton Health Sciences itself, mm-hmm. Because it is trying to show that Dr. Irene Cebulski wasn't removed because of gender discrimination, as she claims.
That's the
heart of her claim, is right. That Dr. Cebulski was the first female head of cardiac surgery in Canada, mm-hmm. and she says she filed the claim because she felt that her removal left such a poor legacy for women in surgery, and she felt obligated to make this claim, you know, on behalf of women and what she says is the glass ceiling that's still there. Hamilton Health Sciences is vigorously defending itself against that claim. And so what they're trying to do is show that why she was removed was because she was an ineffective leader. And so a lot of the allegations have been brought forth by Hamilton Health Sciences in their attempt to show that Dr. Cebulski was not an effective leader. And many of those allegations Dr. Cebulski denies.
And so the bulk of the information that you've been reporting, these scenes in the OR and this, the conflict and so on, this is information that Hamilton Health Sciences has provided at the tribunal themselves.
Yes, much of it has come from their own internal reviews or from their lawyer bringing up some of these situations, or some of it was brought forth by Dr. Cebulski but has been acknowledged by Hamilton Health Sciences. You know, they might have different takes on why that is. Some of the things they have raised is, for example, there was a neurosurgery review. It was raised as a comparison to the review done in Dr. Cebulski's own department, mm-hmm. because she claimed that review was done as a fishing expedition for her dismissal, mm-hmm. where HHS is trying to show that that review is pretty typical of a review they would do in a department, so that's why they brought forth the neurosurgery review themselves. So it has been a very interesting case, that a lot of the curtain that's been pulled back on the dysfunction in the operating room has been brought forth by Hamilton Health Sciences, mm-hmm. itself.
She was dismissed 3 years ago or something?
In 2016.
In 2016. So some of the scenes you describe in the series, you know, surgeons arguing over patient care while a patient lies on the operating room table. So these were scenes in detail related at the tribunal by the hospital's lawyer. The lawyer's defending the hospital, but he's presenting these scenes. Is it fair to say that the lawyer then is painting a picture of discord and conflict in the patient care in the cardiac care unit, because it's a result of either Dr. Cebulski's leadership or is linked to tension stemming from the crush on resources that one would expect of any surgical unit? Or what's your take on that?
The lawyer, this scene was actually discussed quite in depth, this scene in the operating room, because lawyer was trying to argue that this shows some of her ineffective leadership, that this was sort of a dispute over what patient should have been operated on first. And the lawyer's point was that she should have waited until after the surgeon was done surgery and then spoken to him about the fact that he took a different patient first than she thought he should have. And instead, she went into the operating room to confront him and caused this situation. Mm-hmm. But her argument is that doctors go into each other's operating rooms all the time to talk about case prioritization or different things about cases, and that she didn't go in there to have a confrontation and was not expecting this conversation to become unprofessional, and she blamed the surgeon for it becoming mm-hmm. A confrontation. And it's been quite interesting that doctors who testified actually couldn't agree on whether it was a normal thing for an anesthetist said no, this shouldn't happen in an right. operating room. Another cardiac surgical assistant said that doctors talk about prioritization in cases all the time, although he acknowledged that that should never result in tension during the case. So what the lawyer himself used the word dysfunction to describe what was going on in cardiac surgery at the time. And of course, he's doing that from the view of the dysfunction is caused by Dr. Cebulski's leadership. Dr. Cebulski obviously, well, first of all, I'd like to say that she made it quite clear she didn't feel the department was dysfunctional. And she, you know, obviously denied that these things had anything to do with her leadership. And so that's sort of the picture that was painted, though, has definitely been one of a dysfunction and very deep divides in the department.
Right. And that's the word, you know, all these words that I mentioned at the top and in the series, you know, the cluster of bad luck and dysfunction, serious problem, all these things are words that were used in the tribunal by by the HHS themselves. Dr. Cebulski, has she been testifying, if that's the right word, at the tribunal? And have you seen her there then while you've been at the tribunal?
Yes. So basically, when you're at the tribunal, it looks a bit like a courtroom in that the vice chair sits at the front, just like, you know, a judge would in a courtroom. And Hamilton Health Sciences, their lawyer, Rajanan, he sits on one side of the court, of the room. And Dr. Cebulski sits on the other side. Dr. Cebulski is representing herself. She's actually in law school now. She's no longer a surgeon. She's in second year of law school at Queens and is representing herself at this hearing. And then there is a witness sort of a spot where a witness would sit, like a courtroom. But where it is very different than a courtroom is that obviously you're not in a courtroom. You're, you know, maybe in a hotel room, and there's very few people in the room. So where in a courtroom you would have a court reporter, you would have various other people in the court who are coming in and out. You'd have lawyers coming in and out. This is literally just a small room that has the two parties and the vice chair, to the point that when witnesses have come, I'm very noticeable, you know, sitting in the room. I'm usually the only person who's sitting there witnessing. Occasionally, someone from either party will come to support them or be there. But for the most part, I'm one of the only witnesses in the room. And, you know, I've even been introduced to witnesses before, which you would never see in a courtroom.
Just to let them know that the media is there, sort of thing?
I think it's just because it's such a small room and they're introducing the people in the room, it's just be very awkward to leave the only other person in the room out. So I think it's more just, you would never see that in a court, to have observers, introduced. Observers aren't really part of the part, you know, no one really pays attention to them in a normal courtroom at all, where everyone's sort of aware of who's in the room, just because it's such a small space. And we were there for the spectator was there for the cross-examination of Dr. Cebulski by Rajanan, and we've been there for some of the witnesses.
The takeaway message from the series to me, and perhaps sort of the reason that kind of gets at why we're doing it, I suppose, or but maybe I'm speaking on a turn, is that there's a line you write early on in part one, that all this infighting and dysfunction and so on raises questions about quality of care in the cardiac and neurology departments, which is sort of the bottom line. Is that kind of the payoff line? Is that the takeaway from the series? Is it the question of quality of care and what this reflects in that?
Well, absolutely. I would like to say first off that both Dr. Cebulski and Hamilton Health Sciences have said that they do not feel that any of these issues impacted quality care. And also some of the witnesses who worked there have said the same thing, that they all feel that they provided quality care. But without a doubt, some of the issues raised there do raise questions about patient safety and about quality of care, particularly one surgeon practicing for years who had identified issues with bleeding rates and mortality. You know, another surgeon who was alleged to have prescribed vast amounts of antibiotics far above other surgeons. You know, there's allegations of surgeons, you know, having deep divides between them where they're not working together. Mm-hmm. You know, there's, you know, you have this argument in the operating room where the surgeon actually had to stop the surgery briefly before being able to continue on. So, you know, without a doubt, these things at least raise some questions about patient safety and quality of care.
This was one of the, I think, it, you know, it struck me that it was one of the points that Hamilton Health Sciences CEO Ron McIsaac was attempting to make in a letter to the editor that ran in the paper after the series. McIsaac wrote, I'll quote from the letter, tensions arise in a high-stakes environment like a cardiac or neurosurgical team, especially when those people are highly talented physicians who are passionate about their work. So what do you think of all that?
Well, one of the witnesses in the case, she's a nurse practitioner in the unit, and she did point out that, you know, they are working on life and death situations, and that she described them as a family, and like any family, they would have squabbles. Mm-hmm. Now, the internal review, I described some of these issues as sort of grave concerns. You know, now it was referring to those concerns in terms of Dr. Cebulski's leadership, but in no way would I say that the internal review left the impression that there was some concern about these issues. And a report done by HHS Human Resources into the issue in the OR definitely stated that, you know, patient safety should never be in jeopardy, and that issues like this, you know, they should not happen. So I think that there's, you know, there's some merit on both sides of that.
You know, I wanted to ask as well, you know, it's interesting, this is so different from a court case in terms of how the information is presented at one of these tribunals. Are exhibits being presented? What are the mechanics of this that you've been waiting to say?
If I had to pick one of the most frustrating parts of this, is that the parties are constantly referring to these exhibits, and these exhibits are things that are really important to both public interest and to people's understanding of the case. So these exhibits would be things like the internal review done in cardiac surgery. In court, reporters can ask for copies of those exhibits, and except in very rare circumstances, where, you know, reporters are able to immediately get those.
It's public information.
It's public information, and it's really important to openness and transparency and accountability of the system. Unfortunately, what happens with the Human Rights Tribunal is they have this odd way of doing things where they force reporters to put in a Freedom of Information request. So it's an odd thing that I can go to the hearing and I can watch the hearing, but I can't receive the application, which tells you why there's a hearing at all, or the defense, or any of the exhibits, until I put in a Freedom of Information request. The problem with these requests are that requests take a very long time, at minimum 60 days, but more often months or even years. So it doesn't really help to get the exhibits months after you've reported on the case. You need the exhibits while you're writing about the case. Right. Now, the Toronto Star did take this issue to court, and they did win this case in that a judge gave the province 1 year to make these to make the tribunal more open and accessible for the public and reporters. Unfortunately, there is a grace period of a year. So we are in, this case is falling within that grace period. So hopefully in April, we'll see some changes that in the future, when we're covering Human Rights Tribunal cases, we don't run into this problem. You have access to the exhibits and the things that really make sure that you're doing a fair and accurate job of reporting what is going on in the tribunal. But for right now, we're still stuck in this sort of quagmire of freedom of information. And, you know, I put that request in a long time ago now, and I still have not received any of the exhibits. They did make an exception and provide me, I first asked for the application and the defense back in September, made a media request for that, and I finally received those in December.
And especially, I mean, this, you know, a human rights case, I mean, it's not a private company issue with an employee. I mean, this is healthcare. Right? It's public money, and obviously in the public interest in terms of healthcare. So these reviews of the cardiac care, neuro, this is all coming from what the lawyer is saying at the tribunal. That's what you're able to report. But you don't have the reports, in other words, in front of you that you're able to summarize and distill for the public.
Exactly. I have to take what I can from the application, from the response to the application, and from what comes out in the hearing.
Right. So I want to ask what's coming next. But first of all, you know, the vice chair in the end, I gather, will make a determination? What's the timeline on this, and what's the end game as far as this all goes?
Well, this could go on for quite some time. The case comes back again in January, and we will be there and covering it right until the end. Hamilton Health Sciences has made it known that it's going to ask for the case to be dismissed. So in January, they have one witness that they're going to finish with, and then they will spend 2 days having hearings regarding the dismissal, and then the vice chair will decide whether to dismiss the case or not. Obviously, if she does, then it's over. If she doesn't, it will go on for quite some time, as HHS would then have its opportunity to present its side of the case.
So you'll be reporting on all that in the new year then?
Yes, in the new year. They have dates right now scheduled up until February, but my guess is that if the case is not dismissed, it could go well past that.
Right. Well, Joanna Frickitich, always fascinating learning and reporting in your work. We look forward to your future reports on this, and thanks for coming on The Message.
Thanks for having me.
I'm John Wells, and we will talk to you later.